Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we have a new horror-themed game, and Joker cinematographer Lawrence Scherr joins the program.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 325 of Real Blend, a podcast that, like Saturday night, it's going to be 90 minutes of groundbreaking comedy, meaning more puns, like Fart the Clown. That's a good start. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor at Cinema Blend and co-host of the Real Blend podcast, and on this week's show, Jason Reitman's comedy Saturday Night opens wide. We have a new horror-themed game, and Joker cinematographer Lawrence Scherr is going to join us to talk about his work on the film. When I say us, I mean, as always, Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., and Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, boys. How are things going this week?
Hey, buddy.
Good to see you.
How's it going?
Good. Very good. This week has been super busy with a bunch of junkets.
It has, hasn't it?
For things that are coming up, a couple of things that I didn't get, not to name drop, but there's a show that you both have watched that I would like to catch up on.
I feel Kevin and I just spoke with our OG Real Blend guest, Mr. Alfonso Cuarón, just a couple of hours ago.
Yes.
I didn't get
Cuarón. He was asking about you.
Was he?
Yeah.
Let me also add Gabe Kovach to the chair. Hi, Gabe. How are you doing today?
Fantastic. Glad to have everyone on the show today.
Good to see you here. Gabe's going to have a new game for us later on that we'll dig into, but we've got a lot of other housekeeping things to touch on. For starters, hello, if you're watching us on YouTube, please hit subscribe, turn on notifications. We are fast approaching. Do you guys know what we're fast approaching?
350?
40,000 subscribers.
Oh, wow.
40,000 subs on the YouTube channel. So people come to check out people like Jason Reitman, James McAvoy, soon to be Andrew Garfield, which would be a lot of fun. Francis Ford Coppola, yes, another good one. And this
or as he asked us to call him, Francis.
Yeah, Francis. So make sure you go to youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast. We drop new shows on Fridays. We also have something called Real Blend Premium, if you guys are
Real
interested
Blend
in that.
Real Blend Premium.
Oh, thank you, Jake. Mm. There are people upset that you didn't sing a theme. It gets you an ad-free version of the show, and it also gets you a newsletter every single week from me, or every other week, I'm sorry, because you're not getting one this week. And of course, if you just want to listen to us on all the different places you get your audio podcast needs met, feel free to do so. That is kind of cool that you guys got Cuarón. That was such a turning point for this show when we got him, and that was only like a 7-minute slot, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was like 9 minutes. It was our first big guest, and it really kind of
crowded in for like a satellite tour.
Yeah, people should check it out for Roma. It's an incredible conversation, and his new series, disclaimer, is genuinely incredible. It's 7 episodes. Yeah, and
avoid spoilers at all cost.
It's special.
It's based on a book, so I mean, in theory, the spoilers are out there. So if you can go into it without knowing.
And this is Apple TV. This is like not week to week. So 2 episodes drop Friday the 11th.
It's 2-2-1-1-1.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Or if you're, you know, if you have a Apple Screeners account, Sean, you can just watch all 7 at one time.
All right. Well,
simultaneously.
We don't want to remind the people how special we are, Jake.
Oh, I was sort of hoping that you didn't have it so Kevin and I could remind you of how special
we are. No, I have it, of course. I simply just don't have the time. That has been one of the interesting challenges. I've been lucky enough to see the entirety of Penguin, and and having to pay attention to where everybody else is because of the way that the show is is rolled out. There's some big things coming up. There's episode 4 is big. You guys
are
Four is terrific. Speaking of DC content with Penguin rolling out on a weekly basis, the Joker is in theaters. And we were lucky enough to have cinematographer Lawrence Scherr join the show. As we were talking about, you know, when we reviewed Joker, the work that Lawrence does with Todd Phillips is really remarkable. It's a beautiful looking film, extremely well shot. We're excited to talk to him about what I thought were some of the obstacles and challenges that come with setting something in a prison, you know, natural lighting. I love the fact that he talks about one of my favorite shots in the movie, which happens to do with Arthur getting thrown into solitary confinement, which tends to be like a shot that you see often in these prison movies where the person who you're following gets detained by the guards, usually thrown into some type of solitaire. Lawrence tells this incredible story about the slot in the door and the way that it leads to the light. Mm. We get into a lot of the unbroken shot that happens late in the movie. This will be a spoiler-filled conversation. I do want to let people know going into it. The Joker, Folie à Deux, has been out now for a little while. Hopefully, everyone got a chance to go check it out in theaters. If you are still waiting to go see it, maybe skip this interview. Come back after you've had a chance to go see the film in theaters. Because this is going to be a deep dive conversation into Lawrence's work, not just on Joker, the two Joker films, but also some really good stuff in terms of working with Todd on the Hangover films and a few other projects that he has done over the years, including some really fun conversation about Garden State, which was an early project of his. So without further ado, let's throw it right to Lawrence Scherr on behalf of Joker, Folie à Deux, here on the Roblin Podcast.
You know what? I've had more than one person tell me, like, why is your webcam, whatever, you know, my Zoom camera, like, you should have one of those out of focus, like, you know, how like I see Eric Messerschmidt do or something. And I'm like, yeah, I know, it is pretty embarrassing. They're always like, you should be like upping your game a little bit on
I think that's the irony of it all, though. I think it's beautiful.
That's exactly how I defend it, Kevin. So thank you very much. I always feel, I'm trying to be a regular dude. I'm not trying to be like a fancy pantsy cinematographer guy.
That's right.
Because I'm not that guy. I am just a dude from Jersey who's like, you know, in there. So, yes. Well, anyway, I'm glad we're doing this. Thank you.
Who's humbly shot some of the best films.
Oscar nominated. All right. All right, we'll dive right into this. Thank you so much for joining, obviously. And this is the Real Blend Podcast. So clearly, you know that we want to get as nerdy as possible. I'm going to open up because we discussed this a little bit on direct message as well about the different aspect ratios that you're cutting in between for the film. And for audiences who are listening to this around the world, there are opportunities to watch this film in 1.43. They struck a 70mm IMAX print at Universal City Walk, which I've seen footage of already. It looks incredible.
I'm seeing it today.
See,
as we speak, in 70. Yeah. Let's go.
It's awesome. Amazing. And so the version that I saw and a lot and most people will probably see when they see it in IMAX is going to be the 1.90, the 2.20 to the 1.90.
That's right.
But can you, as a cinematographer, talk about the narrative conversations you have with your director, Todd Phillips, about which scenes are going to be IMAX, which scenes will be non-IMAX, what those punches mean when you jump up and down. And I guess just from a general perspective, can you explain the ratios, the 2.20 and the 1.90 and the 1.43 and kind of how they all operate?
Well, basically, most movies are shot, and this is like, let's go just in the last 40 years, right? Because obviously things have changed. So let's stick to that for a second. For the longest time, and this is a little bit of a generalization, there were like 1.85 movies. Think Spielberg rarely shoots 2.39, which is the alternative, which is widescreen 2.39 or 2.40, anamorphic or spherical, which means it's basically lenses that are squeezed and then unsqueezed to be widescreen, and then spherical lenses, which are flat one-to-one ratios of like the lens isn't squeezing it or unsqueezing it. And that's kind of the two formats that we see in theaters. And then there's like 70mm film, which is inherently, like, if you think about, you know, Quentin's movie in the Western one. Yeah, Hateful Eight. 2.20 is sort of the native, you know, aspect ratio of that. And so when they created the digital camera that we use, let's say on Joker, the Arri 65, they made it in a native 2.20 aspect ratio. to mimic basically that same large format 70 millimeter camera. So when you generally make a movie, you're often, and again, generalization pre-streaming, deciding, is it a 185 movie? Is it a 239, 240 movie, right? And the spherical versus anamorphic is a secondary decision if you're going to go widescreen, right? And I used to always have this conversation about like, well, who likes anamorphic, you know? And it's like, oh, people who like anamorphic, obviously Quentin loves anamorphic and, what's the difference? Scorsese likes anamorphic on certain things. But then you think like Spielberg rarely shoots anamorphic and Fincher would rarely shoot anamorphic. He shoots super 35, 239. And so there are certain directors that just have like, you know, different philosophies on what they like. Mm. Going back to this film, when we shot Joker, we were like, it's a 185 movie. It was actually one of the first conversations Todd and I had. We often would shoot non-anamorphic. We had never actually shot anamorphic together. We always shot super 35, 235, right? Which then when it's projected becomes 239. And that was like our whole, our whole history of movies. But when we set out to make Joker, we're like, yeah, it feels like a 185 movie. We didn't know why. It was more intuitive. When we set out to make this movie, we wanted to continue the language, but it was like, it felt like an opportunity to do this expanded ratio, you know, aspect ratio thing that happens, which I guess maybe Nolan created. It seems like it, because I feel like the first time I saw it was Dark Knight, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Dark Knight in 70 millimeter IMAX, because he was going from the 239 to the 143.
Because he's a huge anamorphic dude, right? Loves anamorphic. And so he was shooting every sequence that, and he really had to like, you know, as Greg Frazier said and Denis said on like Dune, like burn the boats or whatever that expression is, you know, like you had to make a decision of like, okay, these sequences are going to be anamorphic 239. You can't expand those. You're using every aspect of the sensor or the, you know, the film, you know, and so that's a really hard and fast, like we're going to shoot anamorphic 239 and we're going to expand to another aspect ratio, which is now going to become a spherical lens. In the case of film, it would be, you know, 70 millimeter or 15 perf IMAX or something like that. In our case, we just said, well, this seems like a really nice opportunity because of the music. One, it's just another, it's another tool to sort of, it's like, what an exciting way to introduce a new language, a new film language, right? Like you've got lighting and composition and, you know, camera movement, you've got the actors, you've got all these other tools, but this idea that you can change this in real time, you know, I remember Horse Whisperer, and I don't know if they ever did it, but this goes way back. But I remember Rob Richardson and Robert Redford, the director, talked about those early scenes in New York before they traveled to, you know, Montana or Wyoming to like meet the Horse Whisperer because of the trauma that Scarlett Johansson's character has sort of had, that New York was going to be 185 and claustrophobic in framing and all these other decisions. And in the theater, this was back when you had like, you know, theaters that could do it with projectionists that were like trained to like expand the theater to 239 as they went out to and I was like, that seems great and complicated. Yeah. And now all the theaters would fuck it up. So you can't do that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this idea that, you know, you could do that was like interesting to Todd and I. And so we thought this was a great opportunity because of the music and the language of the movie to like explore this idea of expanding the aspect ratio. And then 220 to 190 felt like a nice compromise.
But then tonally, Larry, Todd gives you a story that's inherently set in a prison. You know, you're not going to Montana like Redford did.
Right.
You know, so do you kind of have these conversations of like, what are you doing for me here? I've got jail cells and courtrooms and all this.
Well, I pitched it to him. So for me, he was probably like, what are you doing to me? Making me think about different aspect ratios as we're trying to shoot. Right.
Yeah.
To me, it was like, it was a fairly easy sell. Because I thought this is an interesting thing. I remember seeing Dune in Playa, which is like where IMAX has their facility, and seeing it expand from 239 to 143.
Ugh.
And it was great. And I thought this is really exciting. And that's why that 70 millimeter, you know, Burbank, Universal City or Lincoln Center or wherever, the 40 screens in the world. That expansion is really quite dramatic and really cool. But even the expanding to 220 to 190 feels like something subconsciously is changing. So Todd, I knew, and instantly together we're like, this seems great. It seems like a nice way to sort of deal with the psychology of the characters and this sort of aspect of what is real, what isn't fantasy, those kind of things. And then it was just the practical consideration of those two aspect ratios. Are we going to go from 239 to 190 or now in our case 220, we decided. And also which scenes, which we sort of created an Excel sheet and marked them all off and agreed on them, but then also protected for other scenes because I knew in the editing room, Todd could have an opportunity to like work with Jeff Groth, the editor, and make decisions that are sometimes just like a one-off shot. And I didn't expect it. I remember seeing an edit and going, that's cool. And let Todd make a decision on what, why that is, you know? And that's also fun about it. Yeah.
Can you think of one in particular? Can you think of a shot that, that
I'm trying to think of the one-off thing. Cause there's a shot when like after one of the fantasies, like it's after, I think it's after the big one with Pogos and the chapel. Yeah, so it goes from the chapel to like them standing and singing one verse, and then it goes to that Pogo's club where he's tap dancing and she's playing on the piano, and it goes to that wide shot from behind and it goes dark, and then it cuts to him in the transport van going back to Arkham.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, and it's and there's a shot where it's like, of course, like the aerial shot that is Arkham, which by the way, that's like amalgamation of, because that was like an early discussion, like where is Arkham, and this is the fun stuff that's nerdy when you're like now doing it and you're like we get to make these decisions. So like Mark Friedberg and Todd and myself are like, okay, where's Arkham? And it's like you create this whole idea of like, well, I guess like if you think of it as New York, let's say, and you've got you know, Manhattan and New Jersey, or and like, oh, is it you know, out on the Hudson, you know, and it's not really, because then we went to shot aerials at Alcatraz. It, so some of that is Alcatraz.
What?
Right. Yeah. I know. It's crazy. What? Yeah.
So I saw Sean Connery running through there. It was really exactly, strange. Exactly. Yeah.
Obviously it's not, it's all been changed, but like we went to San Francisco and said, well, that idea of like an island asylum is kind of an interesting idea, right? Because there's actually an old asylum that's not working in Manhattan on the East River, but it's kind of too constrained. So then it was like, oh, imagine like a curved road that goes out to an island. So we went to you know, San Francisco and we shot those plates, and then we went to New Jersey and shot plates from there, and that's basically what is Arkham anyway, right. So we know that when it cuts to that wide shot, that's expanded. And then it cuts back to like, I can't remember precisely, but it's somewhere in there. But I remember it bounces a couple of times. And I was like, oh, I never noticed that before. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So one of the shots that we have been discussing, I've messaged you about, is the lipstick lineup with the smile. And it is a remarkable shot. I know that Todd said that you guys did it in like an hour. I don't think it was scripted. It's wild. So could you just speak on that? Because I know it's not an easy shot. I know it may have happened quickly, but it's not an easy shot at all. But can you talk about the design of that shot? But also, what are your narrative conversations with Todd about what that moment means?
Well, it's funny because it kind of came organically. We had shot that scene. When we shot that scene and we started the scene, it didn't begin with that as an idea for an ending. Mm-hmm. That kind of came organically from shooting it. So because of it, it didn't come until late in that day of shooting. And I remember it really came in the form of just seeing them, because often we'll yell cut and then Todd and Joaquin and Gaga will just talk. Mm. And that could happen for 5 minutes, could happen 10 minutes. And the truth is, I don't actually always know what they're talking about. And then I just remember, but the cameras are still set up in that position over Gaga towards Joaquin. Mm-hmm. And I just see them messing around with some lipstick. And for me, because, you know, I'm watching it because that B camera, I'm operating B camera and Colin Anderson's operating A camera. We're shooting at the same time. And that B camera was the camera I was operating. So I'm watching them just sitting offset play with this. And then it really what happens is I start talking to my crew about we might be doing something like this here. So let's just watch quietly. So we're sort of out of the way, just paying attention to what they're doing. And we see them messing around with it. And then it's like, okay, well, and everything we do is kind of real time that we're discovering. So there's never really rehearsals on anything. Yeah, that's a place in which we sort of knew something was going to happen. But I remember thinking this is going to actually be quite difficult to line it up. And how will Joaquin know where to line it up? And my memory is even that it was simpler and kind of fell into place way easier than even Todd said. Because to me, they were talking, but they were sort of, you know, imagining this idea that she would draw something. But we never watched it happen until that first take. We tried it. And I remember.
Oh, wow.
So we all the while at the end of those takes, we're sort of slowly pushing in. And it's our focus puller, Shelley Clayton, who were just talking on these very quiet headsets. And we literally just sort of, some of it is obvious, like when the hand goes up, but this idea of like, okay, rack close and now rack back and finding that right pace was all on the first take, because I remember thinking this is going to take a while. And Joaquin, whether it's just he had an intuitive sense, which he often does, just sort of leaned over, we racked, and it lined up perfectly. And I remember, because even the editor, I asked him, he said, you can hear it on the soundtrack. You kind of hear some murmuring like, that worked. And I remember thinking like, what I thought was going to take a lot of time and have to have this like real like mechanical, technical shit, which we never do. We never want the technical aspects of a shot to ever interfere with the making of it. I was like, that was easy. And I think we did it two other times. That was it. And I think it was either the first take or the third take that's in the movie.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Larry, if I could, just to pull off of a similar scene from the first movie then, because it makes me think of one of the most unforgettable moments is him creating the smile out of blood for the very first time. But what people don't think about is you only get like a shot at that, you know, and then you got to completely wipe them clean and yes, start it all over again in the midst of chaos going on around him. So what was that day like? You know, did you have to go through multiple takes to get that shot right? Because it's so iconic.
Right, right. Well, it's also what the thing, and this is the philosophy on that movie, but it's also the philosophy in on like steroids in this movie, is we're never just shooting that shot.
Yeah.
So we always shoot basically the whole thing, right? Always. So it's always the scene from the beginning to the end. And so we're not like picking up that shot, you know? And right. So that shot, it's like there's a crane move that comes, he gets up, he stands up, he does this. It's all happening. And then at the end, he does this, right? So you're like, mostly you're just focused on all the other elements going right, that this is like the least of your concern, but you want to make sure you're in the right place at the right time when that happens, you know? Right. But yeah, very similar, where you're sort of also the first time you see it, you're like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
But we're also seeing it for the first time too. But it's like, you know, I'll give you it's a tiny little thing, but here's an example of Joaquin also just having this weird intuitive sense for where the camera is. They drag him after they sort of escape Arkham when she lights the place on fire, and they climb up on the things and the guards take him away, and they throw Joaquin down those stairs and drag him away.
Yeah.
They throw him in the jail cell. And my team and I, Rafi Sanchez, my gaffer, and I were like, well, we always wanted, like, when they throw him in the jail cell, there was going to be a strip of light.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that shot.
Well, from the open door. Mm. That was always the plan. But then we were like, oh, there's these little like windows. And you see it later in the scene when he goes back in there, and they're like the two other kids that are in there, Bullock and the other guy, are in there, and you just see their eyes. These little windows in which you can sort of open and close. It was literally right before we rolled that I was like, oh, when they close the door, there could still be a little light that just comes through that window. Right. And I remember Rafi and I, we took one light, we just stuck it up high on a stand, pointed it into the room, like closed the door, looked at it like that, and we're like, where should we put it? And we sort of like, well, we'll try it like right here. And then after the first take, we'll make an adjustment, you know? But mostly we were like, it'll never line up, because we would literally need to like start with Joaquin. Nope. They threw him in, the door closed, that little thing was open, and it was like, what? And that was the first take, and it was like literally lined up. If I could have sat him on a mark and did it, it would have, I still wouldn't have made. And I was like, how the fuck did that happen? Like, and it's that thing, like, because it's not like they literally just tossing him in there.
Yeah, it's a hard landing.
And it somehow it's like it just fell right into place. And that's the take that's in the movie, because I didn't want to sit there and go to either Todd or Joaquin like, well, there's this idea of him going, because then it would be like, this sounds too technical. And I don't want to make Joaquin think about hitting a mark. I would never want to make Joaquin do that anyway. Right.
Right. Right.
And that's just the beauty of Joaquin and sort of finding it.
I think. Go ahead, John.
Well, I wanted to, this is a conversation that people are going to get a chance to listen to after they've seen the movie, that we're going to run this the week after release, so we can talk openly about the courtroom explosion and you guys running through Gotham essentially after that. And I have to tell you that explosion was so jarring, you know, and it catches you so off guard. And then as he runs, I felt released somewhat, you know, because of everything that I was feeling through the course of the up to the movie up to that point. Yet I had an opportunity to speak to Todd about it, and he said the conversations with you, even through that sprint through Gotham, were still meant to make it feel claustrophobic. And I was just wondering if you could talk about your approach to that, because to me it's such a release and a freeing moment. But can you talk about how you guys created the sense of claustrophobia even as he was taking that sprint?
Yeah, I mean, that scene post-explosion is one shot.
Right.
It's one unbroken shot from the time he comes to after the explosion. And so then it became, you know, whenever you sort of design an idea of like, let's try to make it feel like, again, it's like, it starts with a conversation like, well, I remember when we first had it on the paper, there was like an idea. He'd get thrown in a car. We cut to that car driving through traffic, and then, and you're like, why? What's that about? I mean, it's obviously, it's like, well, that's the mechanics of it. What happens? He gets some Joker acolyte, throws him in a car, and he escapes, right?
Yeah.
And they take him, and it's like, well, what if we never left him? And then starts the conversation. I'm like, well, what if we never left him? Okay, start there. And it's like, okay. And then you start just thinking about, well, how would you design shots to tell you some information? Because if you never leave, that has its own power. It does, right? But it's limiting. It's limiting in the way that, like, if you follow somebody the whole way, yes, you do feel like you're them, but you never feel, you never see their face, right?
Sure. Yeah.
This is going to be tangential, but I'll give you an example. The opening shot of the movie where the curtain opens from the cartoon, we travel down that hallway, we pan into the... into the room, the door opens, and you see Joaquin for the first time as Arthur. Then we hinge with him, and now we are following him through there. Well, similar idea. It was like, well, we never get ahead of him, meaning I want to see his face.
Yeah.
Right? I see his face for that minute, but the minute but we also want to follow him because we want to feel like we're him.
Yeah.
So there's a hidden, really, it's a little like an in-camera Texas, it's not even a Texas switch. It's really subtle, but he goes and we're following him, and it leaves him to see that Bullock character get dragged out of his cell.
Right.
If you're following him, so imagine we're following him, we pan off of him, and then when we pan back around, now we're leading Joaquin. Well, that obviously is an impossible thing. You can't follow somebody, leave them, and then they suddenly end up in front of you again.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So that's just like a little way to go, well, I want to still see his face for a part of this walk.
Yeah.
And that just came out of going, okay, well, I guess he'll wait when we pan. He'll jump around and now be waiting for us as we come around. And he just keeps walking. Mm-hmm. And so it's a tiny little thing of like, okay, when you design these shots that want to feel like one thing, how do you also get in front of them, but also follow them? And so that becomes the technical thing.
And Todd doesn't storyboard. Does he storyboard at all?
No. But what we did was we said, let's just test. The thing we needed to test were two things for that little sequence. One was, how are we going to be in the car? because we knew we wanted to be sort of, he was going to get thrown in the back seat. And so the first idea, and this was like early prep, I was like, and this is the benefit of even being on a studio movie, not let alone a movie that's like a sequel that has some money, but like you take a junker car and we're like, how would we photograph this? So we cut out the actual like floorboard of the back seat, raise the car up like 2 feet. So the operator can be in there with like a little Sony Venice Rialto, which we shot that whole sequence with, and be able to pan 360 all the way around, but also feel like you're hiding with him in the car.
Right.
And then that little section is done on like a volume, you know, where we can do like all the backgrounds are done with LED plates that are sort of in real time. Wow. So that when Joaquin looks up and he sees like the fire trucks coming, we're all reacting to the same thing. And when he comes out of the tunnel, cool. The lighting changes and all that. So that was one thing we had to figure out. And the other thing we had to figure out, which was a harder deal, was like, how do we get him out of the car?
Yeah. Right.
Because there you go, okay, it's easy to get him out of the car, which is what we see, but it's the same thing as that opening shot.
Yeah.
Is how do we get now in front of him? Because if we're only following, we don't feel that sense of like emotional connection, because you're just on his back. So that's why, like, if you see it, and we tested this at the back lot in prep with just like cameras and a thing, which is one, a handoff, which would be like, take the camera inside the car. It's like a little Movi, you know, Ronin type of sort of thing. Same Venice camera, but we have to like follow him out of the car and hand it to somebody, two grips, who then run after Joaquin, right, at full speed.
Right.
But then you know how he sort of goes down the path and somebody opens a door?
Yeah.
And then he double backs. The double back allows us to now get in front of him. and then somebody grabs the camera on like a grip tricks, which is like a little like souped up like golf cart, for lack of a better word. Now they can, because he's going to run as fast as he's going to run. We're not going to go slow down. So we had to be on like a vehicle that's going full speed, because he would basically outrun us. And so it's like a handoff back to a car that then is now in front of him, so he can run away so we can see the guys get hit. Because the other thing is, if we stand on his back the whole time, you'd never see that guy get hit by the cop car.
Right.
We have to design like it. So it was like that kind of stuff we had to figure out in prep. That's a pretty complex shot, I guess, because it's like four shots in four environments, because when he leaves the stage, which is like the courtroom, we then have to make a blend to get him outside where he's now. And what's interesting about that shot is that's also a handoff where we have to hand it off. We're following him on stage, but then on the exterior shot, which is the blend, it's a crane, because you can't get up there and then go down those like rocky paths, because people would trip and all that. So that's a crane. And then when we get to the bottom, the crane, we take with magnets, you take the camera off the crane. And this is like a little bit of a VFX fix. But then as we pan to see Joaquin's reaction, you literally in the dailies would see the crane guy, who has like this amazing crane base that can move with like an engine. He's driving it out of the shot to get it out of the shot for the rest of the scene. So like he has to, like, once we hand it off, we're like buying 10 seconds of time so the crane can start to leave the set. But when you see it in the dailies, he's still in the shot. But because it's supposed to look like, you know, like mayhem, we are able to erase that and all that. So it's a shot that most people hopefully don't perceive as even being one shot. But obviously it has a lot of moving parts in there.
Kev, I just want to steal one quick follow up. I'm sorry about that. But you frame, is Harvey Dent framed to become Two-Face in that shot? In the courtroom explosion?
I think so.
You think so? Okay. Well, I caught it.
Half his face is like all bloody.
Okay, good. I only got a chance to see it the one time, and it happens quickly. And I was like, oh shit, did we just see the origin of Harvey Dent?
It's a great shot.
I think so. I mean, subtle, but it's not like crazy, but it's that's what it's meant to be. That's what I think it's meant to be.
That's awesome.
100%.
Thank you so much.
I think the first time I ever noticed your cinematography was when I saw the first Hangover, because I had never really seen a comedy shot that way. And for me, and I know there's a lot of great comedies out there. I think Blues Brothers is one of the greatest shot comedies I've ever seen as well. But there are great.
I agree. But I agree.
It's phenomenal. But generally speaking, comedies, I felt like I over the years haven't really had the best cinematography. And I remember the shot of Ed Helms waking up for the first time after the events and that camera being like the Requiem for a Dream style type of shot stuck to him as we follow him. And I just always found that movie to look so phenomenal. And I was just wondering, one, that Ed Helms shot, your memory of setting that up, your conversations with Todd, but also making a comedy shot the way every other film is generally shot and like giving cinematography a leading character in a movie like that.
It's interesting because obviously I sort of was making comedies all along, even before I met Todd, right? Even if some were like, you know, I did this Club Dread movie, I did this movie Dukes of Hazzard, I did I Garden Love You State. Man. Garden State is like a dramedy comedy, but has comedy, of course. But I remember bumping up to like studio comedies and thinking temporarily, like for one movie, that like, I think I have to change to like what a comedy is supposed to look like. But it, I, even intuitively, I knew that was a mistake because, you know, Tootsie is shot anamorphic, which is rare for a comedy. And it's like kind of in masters, and it's like it always looks like a movie to me, even though obviously it has some, it's like it's a movie. It's like it's Owen Roisman, and it's like it's just a movie.
Hell,
and
Ghostbusters so, looks good.
Of course. Really well. Yeah. And so this idea of like, wait, why do the rules change when we're making a comedy? And then on Hangover, I was like, no. Whether I get fired, whether like the studio's upset, it doesn't matter. One, I knew Todd was on board with this because I even noticed in Old School before I worked with him, there's like a little shot. It's like a throwaway shot where Will Ferrell's like driving and he's like, it's like, it starts looking out the window and just makes a soft little pan to him. And he's like leaving a voice message. And then there's another scene where they're like driving up to the frat house. And it does a similar thing where it's kind of messy. It kind of feels indie. And it's not meant to feel, and it's just, and I remember thinking, yeah, this is why I like Todd instantly. Cause I'm like, he's not subscribing to some comedy rule. Right. Yes. Or at least he appreciates that when it just feels like authentic and real. And then, and so on Hangover, we just always went by the idea of let's just make a movie. The circumstances are funny. These guys are going to be funny. We don't need the visuals to be funny.
Yeah,
we need this to feel real. Like, what the fuck if you woke up and couldn't find the groom and you couldn't remember anything? Like, that's enough. Like, that's a police procedural, for lack of a better word. So, like, let's just go make a movie and make it feel like real to its circumstances. And then that manifests itself with like things like, I'm never going to cover the sun with silks and all the things that make it feel like a movie and give you this like uber control, right? And all the things that manifest like to me as we're now in a movie, right? And so Todd's the greatest about this, and this has been true our whole career. He'll be like, well, then let's shoot the scene over two afternoons because the light's going to be better, rather than shoot it at noon where you would be like, this looks like shit, so I'm going to cover it up. Instead, it's like, well, if you shot over two afternoons, then we can do it and it will look great and we can do it in less time. And those kind of things make a huge difference because you're like, I'm not going to subscribe to like changing the rules because it's a comedy. We're just going to make a movie that is authentic to the scene that we're shooting. And that's kind of where it got born out of. And Todd's the best because he really embraces that idea of like, well, let's shoot it over dusk, you know?
Larry, we'll get you out of here on this one if we could. Kevin had mentioned Garden State. I can't leave without bringing it up. It's 20 years.
Since 20 you years. On that
film. Great 20 years. This year. Yeah.
Oh, I know.
Such an influential film for so many people. But specifically, I wanted to get the opportunity to ask you about framing the most iconic shot from that, which is Zach wearing the shirt that matches the wallpaper. What do you remember about putting that together and the challenges that came with capturing that one shot?
Well, again, that's one of those scripts, like any, you know, great script where you're, it tells you so much, right? And has so, it had the music in the script. It had so many of those things in. But there were so many of those little things in Garden State that I remember being like, how the hell are we going to do this? And it's early enough in my career. There's another scene in the movie where they go in the motel hallway and they're like, there's like a camera obscura. They've set up a lens to like be like peeping Toms. And there's all these creeps, including like one of the producers of the movie as an extra. And I remember early on saying to Zach, like, how are we going to do that camera obscura thing that's in the script when they're in between the hallway? And he said, that's your job. You're the fucking photographer. And I remember going, oh my God, he's absolutely right, by the way. And so similarly, it was like, okay, what are the challenges with doing the wallpaper shot? And what you realize is you're like, well, and this is why I love sort of just thinking and testing whatever it is. It's like, it needs to be actually very flat lighting because you want the sort of, not just depth of field, but you want the sort of perception of the shirt and the wallpaper to be exactly lit the same. So it can't be like lighting that would sort of differentiate that. So that was the first thing of like trying to figure out how to execute this. So it really felt like they were, like he was blended into the wall.
Right.
And I remember trying to test that as early as possible to figure out like, right, this, I know what it wants to feel like on screen, which is like that he's part of the wall, but yeah. it was not quite as easy as I thought, and it took a little bit of finagling, but the main thing I learned was like the flatter the better on the lighting.
That's awesome.
Very, very cool. That's awesome. By the way, we have a little more time. I told them, I said, I want these guys to have more time, but don't box me in. So we have some more, I think, Michelle.
Kev, you wanna?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll ask this because I always find it interesting because at the end of the day, with the new Joker film and obviously the Hilder's music on the first one and this one, there's got to be a poetic nature to you finally seeing your visuals set to music in the final films. And I do want, and you mentioned Garden State, all these movies that you've worked on and all the music that's been a part of these films. I'm just curious the emotional relationship you have to your images set to music. And what that feels like to then see everything you've shot set to score and soundtrack. And do you have memories of certain films that you saw in the final product and just the way your visuals sing with that music?
Yeah, I mean, that is always an interesting component when you, I mean, like Garden State would be a good example in the sense of like the only living boy in New York, that idea of that great abyss and when they stand up on top of that piece of equipment and they kiss for the first time and the camera pulls back. And I knew that song, you know, the Simon Garfunkel song, The Only Living Boy in New York, was going to be used. But when you feel it with like the music, the mix on screen, it does have extra power. The fun thing about this movie was because there was live, everything was live, right? They were singing live. There was a pianist that was playing the music live. So behind the set walls or wherever we were, there's a piano and that pianist is playing the music in not for the actors, but the actors are sort of guiding the pace of that song. So if they change the pace, he's sort of, it's again, this kind of real time jazz thing. And I remember, so we get that in our headsets, in our ears as well. So I can hear the backing, like orchestral thing that they've been pre-mixing with their live vocals, which was a really exciting. And the best part was Gaga, who's obviously an incredible singer, had like a 10 or 20 minute like warming up her throat thing. So this idea that like one of the greatest iconic musicians and singers on the earth, you would get just sitting in the set, you know, right behind where our cameras and all that, or warming up her voice on set every day, was like every day was joyful. Like every day I'm like, this is amazing. Like, it's like you get this opportunity, not just to work with her, but you get to see like her warm up her voice before she goes out on stage and perform for our cameras. And that was super fun. But then when you see it on screen and now it's like fully three-dimensional with the exact mix and then like Hilder's score interwoven with it, and you know, even the most recently time, you know, recent time I shot it, that does have, I even notice things I've never seen or heard. Mostly I'm hearing things for the first time when I watch the movie now, because and every time I watch it, I feel and hear the decisions that are made in those places with music. It's awesome. It's awesome. And listen, I love movies, and that's the reason I'm sitting here and why we're all sitting here, right? Mm-hmm. It's, I didn't come at it from some other place. I came at it because I liked photography, but I also really just love movies and then wanted to be a part of this experience of making them. So there's never not a moment where I'm not sort of thrilled by the opportunities that I have to be a part of making movies and see them on the big screen. It's always incredibly thrilling to me.
Do you remember a shot at a younger age that sparked your understanding of what a cinematographer can do, or a shot that was maybe moved you subconsciously where like, oh, that's maybe you didn't know you were going to get into the field that you're in, but I don't know, a shot that was pivotal for you.
To me, Close Encounters of the Third Kind like was so formative, yeah. Like because the photography and the lighting in that movie, and even just when like all the aliens are coming out at the end and they're all backlit and their shadows and all the sort of light is interacting with them. I think that stuck with me forever, the power of sort of expressive lighting. And that I remember feeling in my bones of like, not only was it a really beautiful and transformative story about something that's science fiction and wonderful and scary when they take that kid and sad when like the boy comes out and hugs his mom at the end and, you know, and they exchange places and all of that stuck with me. And I remember thinking, oh, that's both populist entertainment at its highest form and also, you know, art. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that movie and Jaws and Rocky, which is also populism, but has
Steadicam.
Yeah, and it just has like authenticity to it. Like when I go back and watch Rocky, which is still one of my favorite movies, it feels like Philadelphia. Yeah, it's a movie, but it's just, it feels like raw and it feels messy and it feels like they've transported me into this world of Rocky Balboa.
Knowing that this is a spoiler conversation, Larry, this is the kind of movie that whenever I talk to anybody who has had a chance to see it, I'm going to want to know their interpretation of it. What is your interpretation of the ending of the film? Do you believe that the guy who cuts himself ends up becoming the actual Joker, or is the idea of the Joker going to get passed from person to person to person?
That's a great question. I've thought about it. I think it's probably more the person to person thing, in so much as it's like you met a guy and you're like, this dude, it's like a legend. It's like, there was this guy who was in our prison, who was in our thing, who was this. He wanted to be a comic and he wanted to do this. And he had this weird laugh and all this stuff. And then it's like, you're actually the person. Because I don't believe Arthur is a criminally insane. I don't think he's a criminal. I think he's a severely damaged human being, but he's faced massive trauma and he doesn't know what all the things, but I don't think he's a mastermind criminal. And so like, but the Joker is. And so I think, yes, I think he dies so somebody else can be born. Right.
Right. Yeah.
No, I was just kidding. And whether it's that guy or a future guy, it's like,
right. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. It was, and by the way, in the sense of like, there are more than one Joker that have been, there are many, there's six or so. I don't know what it, you know, if there are a lot of Jokers that have been portrayed in the universe of this story. And And so absolutely. It's the same idea. It's like, there is no one Joker. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But speaking of that shot, the way that shot is designed, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a few weeks since I've seen it, that the character in the background that is cutting his face, as an audience member, that whole frame, there's so much going on in that moment. Like we could look at Joaquin, we could look at the guy behind him. I believe that guy behind him is out of focus, if I remember correctly. Could you talk about the use of a frame narratively in that moment? Because we could go back and forth in that moment. We could look at Joaquin while he's dying, or Joker, or we could look at that guy. How do you envision us watching that shot?
So for me, because I'm so connected to Arthur, that's why the focus is on Arthur, right? We want it to feel like this is Arthur's final moments, and this is like us tragically watching this person, you know, die. But it's meant to be, but also there's something happening back there that's actually really important, but maybe you don't even notice it the first time. I think is like, you know, how I sort of imagined it, which is I really am focused on Arthur and his last moments. But yes, there's something actually interesting happening back there. But again, our focus is on him. And that's why it's not like a split diopter or some crazy depth of field that would allow us to see both. Because I want the audience, you know, we want the audience just to be focused on him.
Yeah. Mm. Tragic. Tragic is the right word to put to put there because of the way that story comes so close.
One of my favorite shots, and it's, you know, it's, I don't know, it's that shot when he cut back to Harley and Joker and he's singing, you know, I want to find young son, and he's sort of budding his mouth and all that. And that cut back to Lee and to Gaga. Mm-hmm. There's like a messiness to the flair, and she looks so 1970s, mm-hmm. and it's like messy and sort of hard light. And I don't know, there's something about that shot of her that's one of my favorite in the movie.
Did you actually film the moment where they're dancing down the stairs? Because that's not actually in the film, right? Where he's kicking and like is that an actual scene you filmed, or is that just how did that not make it into the film? Just out of curiosity, it's such a great shot.
I mean, I think it was about the pace and all the reasons that Todd. I mean, the Todd is an incredible filmmaker, bar none, and really underrated in so many ways. And I think one of his greatest talents, I mean, he obviously writes all his own stuff and he's an incredible director with actors and all the things, and a great leader, is he's a really, really good editor. And obviously when he edits with his editors, and so I try not to really get in the soup about it. I remember liking that scene, and obviously marketing uses it in a lot of their materials, but I think it's like, there are so many reasons when you don't use something. And this happens in every movie I've ever been a part of. There's a great scene in the first Joker in a bank with Zazie Beetz that is one of my favorite scenes that we did. And that had never made the cut ever. It was like out before we even, and I, that standalone scene, I just loved. I remember seeing like an early cut of it and being like, oh, this is great. But
and you gotta
happens all the time.
Kill your darlings, right? They have to be.
You gotta kill your babies, and you gotta And also as a cinematographer, it's like, that's baked in, man. Like you don't get to control that. And also, nor should I, like, I trust him implicitly. And I think it was probably a pace thing. Yeah.
That's amazing. Mm. Well, Larry, thank you so much for coming on the show, dude, man. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you stopping by.
I love your show and I love what you guys do. So keep it up.
We want to thank our good friends at Warner Brothers and, of course, Lauren Scher for coming on the show. Make sure you go back and check out our reviews of Joker Folie à Deux, or however you pronounce that, in some way, shape, or form, on last week's episode. And, you know, just to point out that, like, one of the things that we do talk about with that movie is that Lawrence's cinematography was really, really great. Maybe the movie in general, I don't even think any of us really hated it. I think we just really, you know, talked about some of the big swings that it took with regards to the first movie and their continuation of it. It's been interesting to see how it's been received. But either way, I think Lawrence did an incredible job shooting it with Todd. And in addition to checking out Joker, we want to point out that a film we've been discussing Saturday night, Jason Reitman's film, is going wide. Jake, you and I were talking about this in a chat about how, I don't know if Sony did the best thing with this release. It feels like there was a moment for this movie and maybe it's passed. I want to get more, put it on people's radar because it's good and really needs to be checked out.
Yeah, it's really great. And, you know, whenever it was premiering at the film festivals, I felt like it was this really white hot title that was sort of breaking its way into the Oscar race. Like a lot of people saw it in like the back half of the Best Picture nominees, but maybe even like a screenplay contender. I don't know if that would be considered adapted. And then now I feel like, you know, Kevin and I often talk about reactions we get from people in our newsroom and our anchor. And I aired my interview with Reitman last week because it was a platform release. So it opened in one theater right behind me here in Chicago and then expands wide on this upcoming Friday. And one of the reactions I got was, didn't that movie come out a while ago?
Really?
Which is never what you want to hear. Because that just means people have been sort of hearing about it for a long time and it's still not out yet.
Well, yeah. Someone said to Jake, I thought I saw this last Saturday on NBC at 11:30.
Hey. It's funny. I feel like, but you know, we've seen, you know, and not that we're using the Oscar race as a marker for how successful a film is, but for a movie that's coming out around this time that very much was a part of that conversation, it feels like that buzz has kind of evaporated fairly quickly.
Like they could put a few commercials for it, like, during Saturday Night Live and get the target audience though? Like,
isn't that? I mean, yeah, you would think so. Unfortunately, I feel like the downside of that is that I don't think a majority of audiences watch Saturday Night Live on Saturday Night anymore. I think they watch it in YouTube segments as they're cut and posted the next day. Once they find out what are the ones that people are talking about, you watch this one, this one, this one.
Dude, you know what's really interesting about that? That's a really good point in that we watch it Sunday, like most people, and we watch it specifically on Peacock so that we don't have to have commercials.
Right.
See? It goes from like segment to segment to segment to segment without having the best. So I just shot down my own thing. All right, let's switch gears completely to a topic that I have no contribution to. I have nothing to say about this. And so I'm going to frame it this way. Sell me, guys, on why I should watch Terrifier 3.
Why you should watch Terrifier?
Well, all of us, specifically.
You would, no. I
Kevin, should not watch
Kevin, back me up. Sean, no. You're not going to like it.
I'm not going to like
My only argument is this. I was against it for so long, and Jake was singing its praises for...
You were on my side.
...years. And I think so...
Welcome.
This is part of a larger conversation, and one of the themes that takes place in Terrifier 3 is there's a character who hosts a podcast that follows true crime and serial killers, and this obsession that we have with, in the movie, the real-life murders that are happening in the movie. They're not real, but they're fictional. But in the story of the film, this character has a podcast, and it rings true to this concept of why we as a society are psychologically so interested in true crime and real life murder. That's why Monsters was a big hit. That's why Dahmer was a big hit. And so I think the reason why I was so hesitant about watching Terrifier originally is because the older I get, the less brutal violence and disturbing things I want to watch.
Absolutely.
As an audience member. But so obviously the major difference here is that Terrifier is not real. And the stories that I was just referring to with Dahmer and Monsters are real stories that are being, in my opinion, served to audiences in a quote unquote entertainment way.
Sure.
I mean, entertainment in general, the definition of that, if you're consuming media through Netflix, that is considered entertainment. And so I saw a quote the other day, because this new Terrifier film, for people out there who aren't familiar with the franchise, this is these are independent films that have made a lot of money for the budgets that they've been on. The last one was cost $250,000 and made $15 million. This new one is going to go on to make a ton of money from what we can see. They've already had walkouts and screenings, people vomiting. And we've heard these stories a million times. I know. But in all honesty, Jake and I watch, and all of us watch, more material than most people. And so the violence in these films, I could see disturbing audiences who don't generally watch things this
brutal. Oh, 100%. Yes.
And so I will say this, and I was off the train. Now I'm on the Terrifier train. I get it. And one of the quotes that came out recently about the there was a ban or something that I think in France, where this is the first film since Saw 3 that has no one under 18 can attend the film.
Minors cannot go see it.
Right. And one of the quotes they put in the press, which I'll paraphrase, was like, it's unrealistic violence. It's so absurdly over the top.
It's not unrealistic. I would equate it to like... The bride taking on all the guys at the end of Kill Bill Volume 1. It's not unlike the ultra violence of that. Just the ridiculousness of that.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But I will also say that David Howard Thornton, the facial expressions that this guy has through this mask, there are moments where he is so scary, and then there are moments where he's just crazy over the top in a clown fashion. Like laughing while he's doing it.
Right. Well, it's not, this is, Sean, you might scoff at this comparison, but it's very Charlie Chaplin-esque.
No,
it's
okay,
very,
so wait.
It's very Vaudevillian. Yes.
So I went down a weird rabbit hole because of your guys' interests in Terrifier, where I watched a couple of scenes on YouTube, so not in context. So I do have a question about these films in general. And Art was paying for something in a store,
in a Halloween store. That's the one. Yeah. I remember I sent you the picture of him with the sunflower sunglasses on.
Great
but
scene.
There was even a bit where he was like looking in his bag for money.
Yeah.
Yes, and the things that he was doing was funny. I was laughing at that. Yeah.
There's a scene in three where he's overhearing a girl talk about him, and the camera, every time she makes a comment, the camera cuts back to him to his reaction. She'll say, they say he's the worst serial killer since Jack the Ripper, and he'll be, all kind of giddy, and then she'll say, well, like, I don't want to have sex with him or anything, and then he goes like,
what makes it brilliant, I think Jake would agree, the way that David plays it, he turns on and off that comedic aspect. Like he is such a disturbingly brutal character. So in terms of the film, I do want to shout out this film because I think Damien Leone is one of those filmmakers who really understands practical effects. And for me, I just turn off and I don't think about the, I'm more fascinated by how he's doing it. I'm like, oh, that's interesting how he's doing it. And there's a lot of really cool visual effects and practical effects, but Lauren Lavera, who plays the final girl, Sienna Shaw, she's absolutely incredible in the film. She comes from a martial arts background, a lot of physicality in her performance. I'm sold. I thought it was really well done. He finally shot Anamorphic. The first two Terrifiers they cost nothing, so he didn't have a budget to shoot Anamorphic. It looks like an 80s film. The score is wonderful. And I know we have a new game today, so this might be a good segue, but Art the Clown has become a very, very interesting character within the horror lexicon. And I read this the other day, I think it's Spirit of Halloween. I want to say he's like the number two bestseller in terms of like products. Like people walk in there and you have Ghostface, you have Michael Myers.
Kevin's coming with a Spirit Halloween quarterly reports. I mean, dang.
But no, it's a top-notch reporting. I actually love Spirit Halloween, but like when you walk in there now, Art the Clown is sitting there in an animatronic 6.5 feet tall, honking his like horn thing
well,
at
you.
You
know what
it's
is?
Like,
he has a distinct look. There's a distinct look to the character.
It's terrifying.
That sometimes that's just half the battle is coming up with a recognizable bit that has him stand out. But let's transition. Speaking of Art the Clown, Gabe has a new game he would like to bring forward that might cause some division here. It's the movie horror villains bracket.
Oh, come on, Gabe.
So we're going to try
to come up with Art's in this.
The most classic horror movie villain.
All right. So the only bad thing is we're a half hour into the show. So this will be a quick bracket. We're going to move through it. I'm thinking we'll have some good, if we enjoy this, we have time, we have fun. I think we have some time rest of the month to bring in some horror movies, live in the month of October a little bit. If you're a video watcher, this is pretty straightforward. For the audio listeners, I recommend come popping on the video because it is fun. But we have a bracket in front of us, kind of tournament style, and we're going to go sort of one by one with these matchups and try to determine
These are really tough, man.
Horror movie villain. Thank you. And let's get it started with Art the Clown versus Chucky.
Art.
I would have said Chucky. But
Chucky never really like did it for me.
Yeah, same.
And I feel like Art, even having not being a fan of the movies or like being in it, I enjoy everything I see from.
Look
it.
At that face.
It's tough, and this is an unfair judgment, but like nostalgia for me. I had a Chucky doll as a kid.
Sure.
100%. And Chucky is such a great gateway movies for kids. Yeah.
But Jake, we both know that Art's going to get taken out in the next round anyways. Let's just let him go forward.
Yeah, the fact that Chucky didn't even advance one round is a real shame.
Art moves
on. I don't know,
on.
Man. I love Art. Chucky's I mean, I don't love lame. Art. He's a horrible
Chucky's
person. But.
Chucky, he's a doll.
Next, we have
like a doll.
Freddy versus Jason.
I've seen that movie.
Freddy.
Yeah, I got to go Freddy.
Oof. Freddy. I genuinely believe that the scariest concept I've ever heard in a fictional horror film is the idea that you can't fall asleep.
Yeah,
That's fine. I'll go Freddy here as well too. But
Robert Englund's performance.
Oh, yeah, I love Jason too, man. But
amazing, amazing. Yeah, this is a finals matchup.
This is Freddy's so creative.
Yeah. This is not a round one matchup, man.
Exactly. They're all not one round. Yeah, one I know. Matchup. That's kind of the point. But I think Freddy gets the nod for.
Yeah,
being a little bit more of a creative character versus
Jason has better kills. Slasher.
Yeah,
no, I think Freddy has better kills.
No, I think Jason has better kills, but Freddy's a better character.
Yeah,
yes, yes, that's
interesting.
Yeah,
Freddy Jason moves
has
on.
Jason has great kills.
Next, we have Alien versus Predator.
Xenomorph Alien. All the way.
Xenomorph
Alien.
Without wow, question, the easiest one. That?
Wow! Yeah. All right, I vote Predator, but I'm fine to be.
I go Xenomorph.
The Xenomorph is a perfect creation. Yes. Man. It is a perfect creation.
Okay. And the multiple mouths freak me out.
Take like
so
horror
much.
Movie out of it. It is one of the best like to structure your story around design. Characters.
Was it H.R. Geiger's design, man? Yeah. It's I love it.
All right.
All right, now we have The Thing from The Thing, which I'm not taking this specific version of it, but just The Thing from The Thing.
Yeah.
And controversially, The Shark from Jaws.
But Shark from Jaws is not a villain.
Exactly, controversial.
Yes, Bruce. Bruce.
We're not here for that argument.
Bruce.
We're not here for that argument.
I choose The Shark.
I'm
going The Thing.
I'm choosing The Shark here.
Yes,
I'm
Shark's not a villain.
We look to see another day.
The difference is not every one of those characters is, well, I guess,
Alien is working in its
alien
nature.
Alien is working in its nature.
You can make the argument that the Xenomorph's just doing what it does. That you make the argument that the Thing is doing what it does.
Also,
I don't think...
What are you terrified of in Jaws? You're terrified of going in the water because of the shark.
The shark is doing a thing that sharks don't normally do. It's not just being a shark. It's going after the same people.
All right, I'm going to jump in. I'm going to jump in because this is not today's discussion. We've had it. But Kevin did correctly point out this is why I matched these up round one, because they're both creatures, quote unquote, living naturally.
Yes,
I know
the alien technically
in a bubble, dog.
Exactly.
The alien technically isn't a villain. The alien,
right, Kevin?
But it's the thing that scares you.
When we sit down with Ridley Scott, I want you to look him in the eyes and you tell him that the Xenomorph is not a villain.
I bet you he thinks the Xenomorph is not a villain.
I don't think he cares.
Yeah, that's what he's gonna say.
That's a great answer. I would rather this pop to the other side of the matchup, but do you guys want to go to the other side?
Let's go with this.
All right, we'll finish the left side, then we'll go to the right side. Art the Clown versus.
I mean, it's got to be Freddy.
Art, you had a good run, baby.
Yeah.
Xenomorph versus Jaws. I mean, I go Xenomorph here.
I'll go Xenomorph here.
Yeah. I would have said Jaws, but
yeah. I think Xenomorph is,
or Bruce
at that point, is just so much more interesting.
Yeah.
I'll go Xenomorph.
Did you guys know that that's why the shark's called Bruce in Finding Nemo?
Yeah.
I did know that.
Conference final over here.
Freddy
versus Xenomorph.
Yeah, I got to go Freddy.
Freddy?
Yeah.
Freddy.
I think I do too. Yeah.
All right. Freddy moves on.
That's a tough one.
Freddy moves on to the final. Now it is Stephen King versus Stephen King. Jack Torrance. Versus Pennywise the Clown.
Pennywise.
Yeah, I'm gonna go Pennywise.
You go Pennywise?
Yeah.
Because Jack is a. I don't know. It's interesting. Pennywise is doing. Well, they're both doing it maliciously, but
it's Pennywise. I'm trying to
think. It's Pennywise.
Just the whole idea of, because keep in mind, Pennywise is not a clown. It's the idea of the thing that is most scary to you. Like all four of us would see a different thing if he was standing in front of us. And to me, that is a brilliant idea.
Do we argue that Jack is taken over by some type of presence rather than?
I don't know. Well, it also depends on if you've read the book. Like the book.
Yeah.
Like there's that's a conversation for another day.
He's definitely a villain, and he definitely does horrible things. And obviously they're unspeakable, but I feel like.
This is coming from the images that you're seeing in the movie. I think Jack Torrance.
Yeah.
It's Pennywise.
I was feeling Jack Torrance. Pennywise is fine enough.
I think so.
We have Jigsaw versus Leatherface.
Leatherface all the way. Without question.
I think Jigsaw's more interesting.
I think Jigsaw's been in one good movie.
And you got to keep in mind, he's dead a majority of the series. A majority
Saw
of the Saw movies
awesome.
Are people remembering Jigsaw.
Although the dude is wearing a mask of human skin.
And also, okay, something that I forgot that I was reminded of. I just saw this at like a midnight screening here in Chicago. He has different masks for different occasions.
Oh,
I forgot.
That's nice.
At the dinner scene, he has a mask with like makeup on. He has a dinner face. He has a dinner face.
Formal.
He does. That's why if you watch the dinner scene, you're like, why does that one have makeup on?
Does he lay them on heads?
I looked up because I noticed. I was like, why does this face have makeup on it now? And they talked about it online. They're like, imagine like just changing clothes. He changes math. He changes faces. He changes people's faces.
This is a really disturbing, and I'm probably even remembering it the wrong way. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre was the first time that I can recall seeing a horror movie where a victim got hurt and and didn't die instantly. I think up to that point, I'd watched mostly horror movies where like someone got hit with a club and they died instantly. Right. But in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that girl gets hung on a hook, doesn't she?
Yeah. Yes.
And she still lives.
Yeah.
And and that was a formative memory to me of like, oh yeah, you can get really hurt in these movies and still live and be in pain.
Worse.
And be in pain. You don't just die. You're still like suffering. And I was like, oh, that's really disturbing.
I don't know why they didn't do like the Scary Movie crew. They should have done like Pleatherface. Like fake leather. I don't know why that never happened. That would have been perfect. It's so funny. I went to the Terrifier 3 premiere, and I ran into John Abrahams. Do you know who he is? The guy from who played the Skeet Ulrich character in Scary Movie.
Oh, that's funny.
I was just remembering how funny the first Scary Movie was when it first came out, because it was so like. It was so ahead
Should've
of its...
given him your idea for Pleatherface. It could come back.
Pleatherface, I think. I don't know why Pleatherface never happened.
All right, so Leatherface takes it here.
Yeah, put my boy in there.
All right, up next we have Pinhead versus Candyman. Which, Candyman. By the way, Jake, I think you're with me on this. The Candyman remake requel thing.
It's fantastic.
Nia DaCosta was underrated.
Oh, it was brilliant.
Not good enough love.
By the way, I feel like one of the most underrated horror villains of all time is the villain in Final Destination, whatever that villain is.
Death. Think it's just called Death. Yeah,
but that needs to be up there. That I don't know.
It was an option. It was an option.
One of the most creative, most insane, like the way they do. I got reminded because I see Tony Todd here, but it was you know. Crazy. Such a great
franchise. Voting Candyman in this one.
I'm voting Candyman.
Candyman? Yeah, I feel
like Pinhead is a member of the club. Like he's a Cenobite, but like the whole and the like the tragedy behind Candyman,
this is tough. I don't like this one. Okay. These are my two favorites.
I have a controversial thing to say. In the same way that you guys make the argument about the shark being an animal and all that sort
what
of stuff. I'm going with Michael Myers because he is one singularity. He is one person. Ghostface is like an idea. It's a bunch of people,
which I think is cool in its own right. Like I don't think
it is. But I feel like all the pain inflicted in the Halloween series outside of three has been the result of one person.
This is my hardest one. These are my two favorite slashers.
I've got a Scream poster hanging on my wall.
I gotta go Ghostface.
I'm doing Michael Myers.
But it also goes back to what you were arguing about Chucky earlier. Ghostface to me was more pivotal.
Sure.
But I also think Ghostface is a much more interesting villain. Because the idea of it clearly, but the meta aspect of it, the way it utilizes our knowledge of horror films. I mean, with the irony of this debate right now is Ghostface, you know, is mimicking aspects of Michael Myers. So it's kind of
Michael Myers is the reason Ghostface exists.
But that's the genius of Scream is that the movie itself is influenced by this genre of horror, but the characters within it are influenced by the genre of horror, which are what making the character its own slasher. Yeah. Like it's this fully, cycle that just keeps happening, which is.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be mad if Ghostface advances, but
Sean,
I feel like
so we have one for Ghostface, one for Michael Myers.
I'm going Ghostface.
All right, give it to Ghostface. I'm down the middle.
I'm going Ghostface
so
for this reason.
Wow, I thought I was gonna be the only one.
Michael Myers falls into a Jason category for me of yeah. just like unstoppable force who just keeps marching forward. Ghostface, at least to me, reinvented the concept. Like someone who moves quick, someone who, you know, plays around with the voice, so, like a lot of different aspects of it. I just think sort of.
I get that. I mean, I'm not, like Ghostface. I said,
it's
I'm
a
not,
tough one.
I'm not,
it's
the toughest one. I'm not gonna, lose sleep over this one.
That's the hardest one. And this
if we were doing like a slashers only list, this would be a finals matchup, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Ghostface is going to make it. Yeah.
We have Pennywise versus Leatherface.
To me, it's Leatherface.
It's LF, Leatherface. Baby. It's LF.
Two Leatherfaces?
The face.
Leatherface.
It's the face.
Leatherface. All right, Leatherface.
This is like a 12 seed. Yeah. Shocking the world. Cinderella story.
Candyman or Ghostface? I'm going Ghostface.
Now I'm going to go Ghostface.
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 Yeah. Ghostface, baby. All right, which face is it going to be? Ghostface or Leatherface?
This is hard. Oh,
versus face.
Ghostface.
Ghostface, this, baby.
Leatherface for me.
Leatherface for me.
Yes. Oh, no.
Oh, we got a tie. What do we do here?
The Hewitt family advances.
No. I'm going to switch. I'm going to go Ghostface.
Sean.
I'm
going to go Ghostface.
For this reason. I think Ghostface has been good in more films. Movies.
Yeah.
Consistently good in more movies.
And technically, Leatherface has been in the same movie remade over and over.
Yeah.
Iconic.
Strong, hard disagree. Named Texas Chainsaw the best horror movie of all time.
And I'm not saying it isn't.
Not the best horror movie of all time.
It's up there. The Shining as a singular entity, it's a terrifying movie. And if I were to see that dude in any context, daytime, it doesn't matter. I'm horrified of him.
God. I think we underestimate how scary the Ghostface mask is, too.
But Ghostface is a very effective killer.
But no, it's iconic. Yeah. Kevin, it's so funny you just said Leatherface is not scarier than The Shining or The Exorcist, because I just did a list on my show last week of the top five. And I said not scariest, the top five best horror movies. And my top three were The Shining at number one, The Exorcist at number two, and Texas Chainsaw at number three.
I mean, Shining is, I think, the greatest horror film ever made.
It's perfect.
I don't think you can top
says,
that.
Says a bunch of people who did not advance Jack Torrance past the first round.
Jack's different.
Don't say it's not a horror movie.
It's more of a thriller than a horror movie. Oh,
don't be that person.
That movie is?
Yeah.
Dude. Sean, don't be that person.
Anytime Danny's doing his voice thing, I crunch up in a ball.
I'm not even saying this to be controversial, but like, I don't, like, horror to me is these guys, these final fours. I don't really put Jack Torrance on that list.
It's a ghost movie.
I genuinely don't put it on a list like this.
I think the difference is The Shining has this, it's this ultimate dread feeling in your stomach the whole film. The whole film feels off and evil.
All right, Ghostface takes this. I think this is going to be, I think I might have the only controversial pick in our finals matchup. But the final matchup for the cake is Freddy versus Ghostface.
I would give it to Ghostface.
I would say Freddy.
I would say Ghostface.
I would say Ghostface.
Oh, no.
It's got to be Freddy.
I'm Freddy, and it's not close.
Freddy's the king.
It's closer. Okay, here's your answer.
What did Ghostface say his favorite scary movie is in the opening scene of Scream?
That's true.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's true. I am gonna. I will. Not just for the interest of time, but I am totally okay with Freddy Krueger taking it here.
It deserves to be Robert Englund.
The tie goes to the runner. The tie goes to the runner here.
For the record, I do want to say I think Ghostface should take this. I think Ghostface,
the record shall show reflect.
Yes. I think Ghostface making the finals is fantastic.
I agree. But Gabe, I actually think you're more with me than you're giving off.
Yeah, I was Ghostface, but if we need to make it rather than flip a coin, willing to capitulate, I can capitulate to Freddy Krueger. For
Did
sure.
Did Ghostface turn his hands into hypodermic needles? I think not.
He could if he wanted to, Sean.
Though I have been saying that Scream should do a new Nightmare thing where Scream goes after Neve Campbell and Courtney Cox, and that's how you bring back David Arquette.
It's a good idea.
Because my argument was going to be, has Ghostface ever gone after the actors in Scream?
But holy hell, Wes Craven. How about you?
Yeah, my God, yeah.
Way to go, Wes.
That's true.
I only got to interview him once. Did you guys ever get to interview Wes Craven?
I got him for Red Eye.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a great teaser trailer.
Dude, Cillian Murphy, man, that movie and Rachel McAdams. This movie's great.
Do you guys remember that trailer? Did the first 90 seconds they play it like a rom-com?
Oh, do they?
Yes. And then it's like too cute. Like it's like a meet cute at an airport. And then they happen to be sitting next to each other on the plane. And that then, just says like from Wes Craven. And that's when you're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
It was really good.
So I wonder, looking at this, cause I put the order together. I probably would have swapped Art the Clown and Michael Myers, put Myers against Chucky, which I think would lead to the Freddy Michael matchup, and then Art versus Ghostface. I think that would have ended up the same. I think
that's why we play the games.
I think it's a good bracket. Otherwise,
this is really cool. I actually love this. I think we should do this more often.
I've got some other ideas.
Fantastic.
So thank you for playing Freddy Krueger. According to this bracket,
congratulations, Mr. Krueger.
Yeah. Hey, wait. Can we say really quick? Like the winner of our bracket will be on our show.
When are we running that?
Next week.
Hey.
Right, because it's on digital or on Blu-ray and the 15th.
Oh. So Roger L. Jackson, if you'd come on our show, you would have won the bracket.
All right, on your way out, let us know who is taking your top spot for the bracket of best horror movie villain. In the meantime, as promised, we are going to have Robert Englund and Heather Langenkamp on the show talking all things Nightmare on Elm Street. And it's a really, really great interview. A lot of fun talking to them. It's kind of crazy to think of like being able to talk to them about original things that I haven't heard them really discuss. And I feel like we got one or two things out of them that they probably haven't told before. Yeah. So
because as Kevin appropriately points out, over the course of 40 years, they've told every story imaginable.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you shouldn't stick around for the next episode of Roblin. So until then, we are at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach. The show is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Dunkirk.
Night, bitch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.